Hey everyone, thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Nick Blumberg. Amanda Vinicky has the evening off. Governor J.B. Pritzker joins a hastily scheduled meeting of unsettled Biden supporters.
Joe Biden is going to be our nominee unless he decides otherwise.
The Biden campaign tries to right the ship as some Democratic lawmakers and big money donors start publicly calling for a new candidate at the top of the ticket.
That's what this was all about trying to overthrow a free and fair election.
A Supreme Court ruling, sparked by charges former President Donald Trump tried to illegally stay in power, creates broad new immunity protections for presidents. In other Supreme Court news, the justices turn away cases challenging Illinois' assault weapons ban, for now. Chicago's unfunded pension debt keeps on climbing, up nearly $2 billion for a total topping $37 billion. And public hearings are set to get underway for a bold plan to merge the CTA, Metra, and PACE.
And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Laura Washington of the Chicago Tribune and ABC 7, our own Heather Sharone, Steve Daniels, also from the Chicago Tribune, and Rob Hart of WBBM News Radio. Thanks to you all for being here. Let's get right to it. Laura Washington, the president, his surrogates, his staff have been in damage control mode all week. He had a big rally earlier today. We've got a primetime interview coming up this evening. Turning to that meeting with Pritzker and other Democratic governors, how much of an impact do you think moves like that can really have on the president's candidacy?
Well, we'll have to see. He probably only has several more days to really turn this around, but it seems to me like it was too little too late. Right after the debate, there wasn't a really clear explanation about what happened. It was a lot of things dribbling out. Some of the top leadership in the party were unhappy because he didn't reach out to them directly. There was not a lot of good organizing going on, and there was no clear messaging and no clear strategy early enough. And so now they're really trying to play catch up.
Yeah, not a full court press right after it happened.
Right. Like the interview that he's doing today, that he could have done that interview a couple of days afterwards and maybe quelled some fears and calmed some people down. They sort of let it roll on its own. And when you let a story that you don't like roll on its own, it can get out of control.
Yeah. Well, we started to see business leaders, even some major donors calling for Biden to step down. Rob Hart, if the money dries up, is that likely to turn the tide against the president?
Well, the money is not going to dry up in a meaningful sense because even after that debate performance, the Biden campaign was quick to point out that that was one of the best fundraising days they had had in the history of the campaign. They raised tens of millions of dollars off of that, most of it from small donors. So as long as committed Democrats keep clicking on those Act Blue links, the money is never going to truly run out. What's going to happen here is that the polling, the good polling, the internal polling from the campaigns, that's going to come in and that's going to tell a tale. And if you have enough governors and senators and members of Congress to say, look, not only is this going to be a disaster for you, President Biden, this is going to be a disaster down ballot, we have to make a change. And that is when they're going to start really prevailing upon the president's inner circle and his family to say, hang it up for the good of the country.
Yeah, time for you to step aside because it's the right thing to do. Heather Sharone, former President Trump has been keeping unusually quiet these last few days. We still don't have a VP announcement about 10 days out from the RNC. Do you think the strategy right now is to just let negative coverage of Biden dominate the media?
Well, it's a political truism that if your opponent is drowning, you don't want to reach out a hand to save them. And that's what sort of Trump saying something sort of newsworthy or controversial could really happen. Now, we saw him break a little bit of that silence today, denouncing the plan known as Project 2025, which was authored by his aides and sort of his, sort of auxiliary campaign staff saying, well, I don't know anything about that, which sucked up some of the media oxygen today. And I think that was why we didn't hear from him, because he's at least disciplined enough to sort of listen to the people saying, hey, your opponent's drowning. Don't throw him a landline.
No, and yet, though, he wasn't entirely silent.
He was not.
He was
posting
away
on
Truth Social, which is, that's a tree falls in the forest kind of a situation.
Right.
But he was re-truthing, as they say, QAnon memes and talking about how former Congressman Liz Cheney needs to be subject to a military tribunal. So it wasn't like he was just sitting back and letting the situation come to him. He had things to say, but he was doing it in a place where people didn't pay attention.
Well, he was laying a lot into Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris, the last couple of days, because her name is beginning to emerge as the possible beneficiary and successor if Biden does decide to step aside. So he's highlighting all of the negatives she has. And the thing is, if Biden does step away, whoever ends up inheriting or ends up getting in the fight for the delegates, there's going to be a lot of opposition research the Trump campaign is going to already have ready to roll out for any one of those candidates.
What he's not been doing is rallies and the kinds of things that get a lot of TV coverage. Truth Social, he can't help himself. It's not like he's going to be completely quiet for, 10 days or 8 days or whatever it's been. I think there is a sense that there's a self-discipline here that people are surprised to see from him. But by the way, that also happened during the debate. Yes, he lied over and over and over again, as everybody would expect him to do. But he was disciplined.
He had
Joe Biden unable to complete a sentence. And normally, what you would expect Donald Trump to be doing in a situation like that would be to try to destroy him. And there were a few barbs, but it was not
relatively,
what you would expect.
Yeah, relatively reserved. Well, Laura mentioned Vice President Harris. Steve, the Tribune editorial board had a piece out, calling out some Democrats for floating alternative candidates other than Harris, who's in many ways a logical choice. I mean, how tricky of a situation are they in as they look to a potential successor?
The trick box and frankly Joe Biden has put them in this trick box. But the trick box that they're in is a really, really difficult one to get away from. I mean, what we were trying to say there was whether he stays in or not, she becomes much more of a focal point than she would have been before. And she would have been a focal point before, too. The Trump campaign would have gone after her for sure. The Republicans were teeing her up for a year plus. But this was going to be far more. And frankly, the Democrats need to lean into that. There's been a lot of talk that, hey, she's grown a lot. I thought she did fantastic after the debate debacle in terms of going on the networks and really did an excellent job under the circumstances. So really, the Democrats have no choice. They need to get her out either way. Because, frankly, if you're voting for Joe Biden, there's a decent chance Kamala Harris is going to be sitting there before the end of four years.
Well, the trick box, though, is that she is a logical successor. She's the vice president, but her popularity ratings are almost as bad as Joe Biden's. And it's felt that she hasn't necessarily been of great service as a vice president. So do you skip over her? If you skip over her, for anyone else, it doesn't even matter. She's an African-American woman. Even if you pick Gretchen Whitmer, who's another woman, you're going to have a problem with the appearance that you're depriving a black woman of the opportunity to step up, and she is the logical choice.
But so, logistically speaking and legally speaking, she may be the only option because she has access to all of the Biden-Harris campaign money, that $212 million war chest that they're sitting on top of, and more importantly, she has the entire campaign apparatus at her disposal. If you get anybody else, you have to rebuild everything from scratch, from fundraising to office leases. And as you mentioned, the clock's ticking. You got 18 weeks until Election Day.
Yeah. Well, this week marked the first Democratic congressman to publicly call for Biden to step down. We've since had more come out and echo that. Let's hear some of what the first to jump had to say, along with part of an interview the president did this week, one of several he's been doing in an effort to salvage the campaign.
I salute President Biden. I just feel that it's time for him to step aside if we are to be able to protect what he allowed us to gain in 2020. He delivered us from Trump then. He could be delivering us to Trump this year.
I had a bad night. I had a bad night. And the fact of the matter is that, I screwed up. I made a mistake. But I learned from my father, when you get knocked down, just get back up.
So framing that as simply a mistake, I mean, Steve Daniels, is that likely to resonate with voters?
No, I mean, you can't unring that bell. They'll be running ads. If he stays in, they'll be running those ads over and over again as we go into the campaign with those awful optics. Yeah. What he can do is what he is doing. He's been, to Laura's point, very, very slow in doing it, slower than he should have been. But the interview tonight with George Stephanopoulos, he's doing supposedly doing a press conference
Thursday, next week.
Yeah. Two weeks after the debate.
Exactly. should have already happened, should be happening earlier than Thursday. If he does well in those situations, there's a decent chance that the Democrats will simply swallow hard and say, yeah, our odds aren't great, but the odds going the other way aren't that great either, and we can't make him leave. So,
well, if the president does step down, I mean, Heather, how worried do you think party leaders are about the potential chaos that vacuum at the top of the tickets creates?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've all sort of been joking for years now about living in unprecedented times. We would truly be living in unprecedented times to have a major party candidate step away from the nomination just before he's crowned. It would add a whole other level of uncertainty and sort of, I think, anxiety to the Chicago convention that we're coming up on. I also think that we're sort of dealing with a situation where if it's not Harris, there's really no mechanism to sort of make it somebody else, which means that, you know, you've been dealing with not only inertia and sort of people's fondness for Joe Biden, but also a question of how do we actually make this legally work and how do we avoid making a bad situation worse.
Yeah, all the state-by-state rules, so many complexities there. Well, former President Trump also got a pretty favorable ruling from the Supreme Court this week. This is in a case related to his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. It found presidents have absolute immunity from prosecution for actions related to their core executive powers, presumptive immunity from official actions not necessarily directly related to their core powers. Laura Washington, were you surprised by that ruling?
Not by this Supreme Court. I had a sense, because they were delaying the decision for so long, that they were moving in a direction that was going to probably be favorable to Donald Trump. And you think that the Democrats and other people who don't support Donald Trump were upset about the debate. Listen to what they had to say this week about this decision. This decision, I think, has put a lot of fear into people's minds about the kind of power Donald Trump or any president will have going forward, unlimited power to do anything and to be immune from it. So it was a very controversial decision.
Well, and it follows in a pretty long line of expansions of presidential power. I mean, Steve Daniels, do you think there are still adequate checks and balances in place?
Well, I think, yes. I think that it's not absolute immunity. That is certainly not what it is. The thing I think that a lot of people looking at the Supreme Court, and certainly people with any legal foundation of any kind, where did they get the constitutional authority to come up with this? What is the basis for this? Simply six justices deciding, well, as a practical matter, we don't like it that a president might get second guessed after the fact. Certainly, you can go back to the Federalist Papers or all kinds of things, and that wasn't how our founders were thinking about the executive branch. Now, it is true that the expansion, you know, it's a much more complex world and all those sorts of things. It's a tough call, but I guess the bottom line is, yeah, I think there are still checks and balances, but they've been weakened significantly.
Eroded quite a bit over the years. Also, the Supreme Court turned away challenges to Illinois' assault weapons ban that was passed in the wake of the July 4th mass shooting in Highland Park 2 years ago. It's a victory for gun control advocates, but Heather, the challenge is still moving forward here in Illinois. This isn't quite going away yet.
It is nowhere near done, and we heard from both Justices Alito and Thomas that if it was up to them, they would have stepped in and stopped this law from being enforced, which indicates that this is going to be sort of a subject of much litigation and much discussion as we go forward. The question, I think, really remains is how the Supreme Court continues to sort of parse the Bruin decision, which sort of expanded Second Amendment rights to have all sorts of guns, and whether they sort of see this as sort of an exemption like the one they carved out earlier this term for people convicted of domestic violence, or if they see this as sort of that sort of inalienable rights to have whatever kind of gun you want in really any circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, given that nod from Justices Alito and Thomas, Rob Hart, do you expect that this will make it to the Supreme Court eventually?
Well, we really had the message, I'm going to send your work back to you and tell you how you can succeed next time.
Yeah.
So there's clearly a roadmap for having this case come back to the Supreme Court. It was remanded back to the lower court, so this is not the last time we're going to have this discussion. But once again, between the immunity decision for the Supreme Court and this decision on guns to kind of punt for now, bring it back later, just raises the stakes in the election. And between the panic about the debate on Thursday night and then the immunity decision on Monday, you know, one thing that could potentially carry Joe Biden over the finish line if he decides to stay in is that you have a lot of Democrats with their hair on fire right now about what the Supreme Court can give to Donald Trump. It might actually be a reverse 2016 where everyone swallowed hard on their personal disdain for Donald Trump, but Republicans and conservatives voted for him anyway because they knew the courts were important, and they knew he would deliver conservative outcomes for them.
I think abortion rights are a big part of that, too, because we saw the Supreme Court sort of not sort of stop the federal government from requiring states to provide emergency abortion care in states that have banned abortions under almost every other circumstance. I think that there's sort of the sense that it was sort of a bullet dodged in that specific sense, but there's no doubt that if Trump is elected, he will be moving towards a national abortion ban and that those sort of exemptions would no longer exist in 2025.
And that's an argument that the party has been making strenuously and Biden's making strenuously up to this point in time. Now, as you say, we have two other big issues that they could take advantage of, but they're so mired in this in this debate, which may go on for quite a while about who the next nominee will be, that they may not have enough time
or the strategy
to get it to execute it.
To be fair, on the Trump abortion business, he has said now repeatedly that he will not do a national abortion ban. Mm-hmm. He has said that he said everybody loves it that the states are dealing with this in the fashion that they are. But nonetheless, that's what he has said. Now, everybody can take his record for what he says and then what he does for what it's worth. But just to be clear on that.
Yeah. Well, turning to some city news, Heather, we got new numbers this week about just how bad Chicago's unfunded pension debt has gotten. Really bad. What are the numbers looking like?
So in the past year, the city's pension debt has grown approximately $2 billion to more than $37 billion. And in part, it's because the city and the state has sort of changed the way they calculate that debt. They now are no longer sort of ignoring changes that they made to the way firefighter and police pensions are paid. It's also because, you know, the stock market was really volatile, and that meant that the investment returns were sort of, you know, neither here nor there where they really wanted them. This comes even after the city is paying more than hundreds of millions of dollars more than they're required to in an attempt to sort of start sort of chipping away at this backlog, which is really the legacy left to the people of Illinois from decades ago when the city and the state basically stopped paying these bills because they had other things that they wanted to do with that money. And as all things happen, it is time to pay the piper. And now it is up to Mayor Brandon Johnson and Governor J.B. Pritzker to try to figure out what to do. Oh, and things are even more complicated because a 2010 fix that was designed to sort of solve these issues, well, the bill for that is now coming due. So that is going to have to be on the agenda for the fall veto session.
Well, and we've got this new city council committee that's charged with coming up with new revenue sources. Speaking of spending priorities, you know, if they come up with any plans that get put into action, do you think some of that money could go toward pensions or might it be earmarked for other priorities?
Well, so the idea is that the Chicago Casino, which is supposed to be built in the Tribune Freedom Tower, is supposed to pay $200 million toward the city's police and fire pensions, and that is supposed to sort of give breathing room. Now, if that casino actually happens, that would be great, but the temporary casino has sort of fallen short of expectations, and it's not clear whether Bally's is actually going to have the financial wherewithal to build that casino. Now, if that doesn't happen, that means a lot of that new revenue is going to have to go to those pensions because the city simply cannot just say, we'll deal with it later. That's been tried. The ratings agencies essentially won't allow the city to do that, which means that there's less money for Brandon Johnson to do what he was elected to do, to create more mental health clinics, to invest in the South and the West Sides. So there's really no good option on the table, but that's city government for you.
Those ratings agencies are awfully testy sometimes.
You guys are the moody.
Oh, sorry. That was a AAA rated joke. Yeah. That was great.
Thank you very much. Father's Day has come back.
Yeah, seriously, this is great.
It's Father's Day on a Friday.
Hey, I'll always take a bad pun. No complaints. We got a federal whistleblower lawsuit this week from a former employee of Board of Review Commissioner Samantha Steele. He said he faced retaliation and termination after he spoke with the county's inspector general as part of an investigation. Steve Daniels, is it something of a rarity to see this kind of a whistleblower lawsuit come up in the world of Chicago politics?
No, but it is shining a light on the Board of Review, which we're going to learn a lot more about here in the next year or 2 years. Property taxes we're not even a slow-moving train wreck anymore. The train is really picking up steam in the south suburbs. It's a colossal disaster, right? I mean, there's the property tax bills for homeowners there are up quadruple year over year. It's insane. The same thing is going to happen to a lesser degree in the city of Chicago beginning next year or the year after that. And the Board of Review plays the role in checking the assessor's work. And in many cases, what the Board of Review has done has been to reduce commercial property taxes, which means the residential pays more. So Samantha Steele's in a little quiet, it's not even a quiet war, it's a pretty much an open war with the two other Board of Review commissioners over some of these issues. This whistleblower suit, I think, is part of all of that. And like I said, we're all going to learn a lot more
about
the Board of
Review. And there's an ongoing investigation as well, which is beyond the whistleblower.
Yeah, it's all complicated by the fight over the Arlington Heights property,
the Bears. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, Fritz Kagi, the assessor, basically said, look, if you paid almost $200 million for the property, that's what it should be worth, and that's what you should be taxed at. The Board of Review disagreed, and that's sort of what this whistleblower allegations is all about, which is, again, more indication that the property tax system is very complicated, and you know, is it equitable, I think, is the fundamental question.
Yeah, I think we're going to be learning a lot about that coming up. Well, next week we'll have the first public hearings on a bill that proposes consolidating CTA, Metra, and PACE, also giving them about $1.5 billion in extra funding. You know, Rob Hart, a lot of frustrated passengers angry about service levels in the, you know, COVID era, post-COVID era. Do you think this merger is the kind of plan the average rider might hear about and say, well, yeah, that makes sense?
Well, if you're a weirdo like me and you know the RTA history backwards and forwards, you would know that the greatest pieces of evolution in the history of the RTA, going back to 1974, have all come from crises. Even the foundation of the RTA in 1974 was stemmed from CTA service cuts in the 70s. Two of the railroads that provided commuter service were on the brink of bankruptcy, and that's why the RTA was formed in the first place. And then after the fiscal crisis in 1981, they reformed it again, and that was the birth of Metra and PACE, because PACE took over for a lot of those suburban bus systems that were in various states of financial health, if you remember, like Nortran, stuff like that. That was meant to rescue suburban bus service, which was an iffy proposition 40 years ago. So now we're staring at a fiscal cliff and reorganizing the transit agencies under one umbrella, all the service boards in one place. That would make a lot of sense because it's always a crisis that moves it forward.
And we are certainly in one now with a $700 million fiscal cliff coming up in about a year and a half.
Yeah, just take the CTA. You know what kind of a crisis we're in.
Yeah. Well, and Laura, I mean, elected officials get a lot of sway when it comes to appointing members to these three boards, to the RTA board. Do you think local electeds are going to want to give that power up if we're consolidating?
They're certainly not. They're not going to want to give up the control either. And I mean, and there's a lot of dollars attached to this, and they don't want to give up the control of those dollars.
Heather, we've got about 30 seconds left. I mean, transit leaders of all the agencies have been pushing back pretty hard, including CTA Chief Dorval Carter. Any idea where Mayor Johnson stands on the idea?
Well, I think that's a question. So he saw his nominee to the RTA board, the Reverend Ira Cree, withdraw an acknowledgement that he couldn't get through the city council because he had no specific sort of expertise about transit. So I think it'll be interesting to see whether we see a move towards sort of demanding sort of transit experts to sort of handle these issues as opposed to sort of political sort of friends and sort of people who have helped people get there, sort of the way it has always been in Chicago. And I think it's really sort of a question of, is transit sort of a fundamental government operation or not?
Well, I think a lot of people who rely on it would say probably yes, but we are out of time. You may not be transit experts, but we're glad to have you all here with us. One out of four, pretty good.
Let me tell you about the Rocky
Mountain. My thanks to Laura Washington, Heather Sharone, Steve Daniels, and Rob Hart. And we are back to wrap things up right after this.
Tonight's presentation of Chicago Tonight, Week in Review, is made possible in part by Ann and Rich Carr, BNSF Railway, Francine and Dr. Anthony Brown, and the Mullenhauer Progressive Philanthropic Fund, in honor of Ida Mullenhauer, supporting quality journalism. Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
And that's our show for this Friday night. If you're still looking to make plans for the weekend but need a little inspiration, check out our summer festival guide at wttw.com/festivals. Now for the Week in Review, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night. Okay, weekend plans. Anybody checking out NASCAR, the big race this weekend?
I won't be anywhere near downtown.
My mom lives downtown. She fled to Michigan. So, understandably.
That's going to happen a lot this summer. It's going to happen for the convention. It's going to happen for Lollapalooza.
How do I get out of here? Stay far away as possible.
Well, at least, hopefully, we won't have torrential downpours and massive flooding this
weekend.
Time around.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm dedicated to preserving the dignity and rights of all individuals.